Well, it's my pleasure to be here today, and I appreciate, you know, not only the eldership here at San Marcos hosting Focal Point, but the presence of each of you and thoughts about how it is that the Lord's church can be managed from a leadership position in a way that does glory and honor to Him, but really reaches out and achieves the growth and the development that we want to see in among the members and the reaching out to the communities and things that are around us. I have had over the 20 or so years that I've been preaching, I have worked with congregations that have elders and that don't have elders. When there are qualified and conscientious men serving in that capacity, it makes us think God really knew what He was talking about when He set up congregations to run that way. So I appreciate what it represents for our discussions today and throughout this week when we go home and when we work and when we labor, when we lead. I do believe that you and I live in a time period. Our own period in history is very iconoclastic. We're against authority, people just in general. Okay, whether you go back in the 60s and 70s, and you might have people who rail against, the man or something. But even now, you look on the back of cars, you'll see the bumper sticker that says, "If the people will lead, the leaders will follow." You know, what is it that causes people to want to put something like that on there except they're jaded, skeptical, doubtful somehow about authority in general? And brethren, the truth is, I think that they're even more skeptical or dubious about religious leadership. And if we're talking about people that are not being permissive, but instead trying to walk according to the New Testament standards, they find that even more repulsive, maybe, too stringent. And as a result, there's a great deal of criticism that can be thrown by people. When I think of bumper stickers like, "If the people lead, the leaders will follow," it makes me think that these individuals that put these on their car are thinking, it's the common person, the ordinary Joe and Jane, that is really down to earth, really going to be honest, going to be principled, that is going to be selfless, not just looking out for number one only. And so I think, well, they've seen something in government, in business, wherever it may be, that makes them suspicious of leadership. But I ask myself, what is it that we can do in the Lord's church to make certain that we present leadership as God envisioned it so that that type of skepticism or doubt does not have to exist? Very specifically, what is it that you will do as elders? What is it that I do, for example, as a director of a preaching school, that communicates not only the achieving of our set goals, but that we do them in an honest way, that we're principled about what we're doing, we're proactive about the business that we do seek to achieve, and that in doing so, we are people-oriented. We have a sense that this is a part of helping people achieve goals, not just building institutions. And I'll tell out a little bit on myself. I have to be careful about that because working with a school, it's very easy for me to think, get people to be cheerleaders for the institution. That's not the goal. Now, a school is important. Congregational activities are important. That's true. But they're important insofar as they help make it possible for people to be reached with the gospel and for God to be glorified. So we need a clear sense of purpose about what we're doing. And I believe that if we have those elements that people often think are so lacking in leadership of any stripe, then we're going to have the positive influence that we want, and a reasonable person is going to be impressed with the things that we're doing and proposing. I know there are cranks that are out there that are never going to be really impressed with anything, but the reasonable person will look and say, that makes sense to me. By the way, before I forget, you know that in the book of 1 Timothy chapter 3 and also Titus chapter 1, where it talks about the qualifications for elders, among other elements that are mentioned is the statement that an elder would have a good reputation with those who are on the outside. Now that's with non-Christians. You realize that's a good reputation with people who are not sympathetic or not in harmony or agreement with you doctrinally. They're not in terms of life purpose or future expectations or ambitions, or else they would become Christians and they would be insiders. But even though there are those differences in views, doctrines, principles to operate by, it is possible, by that qualification, for an elder to behave himself in such a way that the reasonable person on the outside can say, I don't agree in these particular areas, but you are still someone I can respect, you seem to be a principled and upright person, and you're a straight arrow, a solid citizen, a good person. we need that kind of reputation. And it's something that we do with the elements that we're going to talk about this morning. When we talk about the four figures that are mentioned for us here, Moses, Joshua, Nehemiah, and Jesus, you know as well as I that in 35 to 40 minutes, there's only very little that we can say about any one of those particular figures. But what I would propose instead is that we draw from a set of instructions that God gave to Joshua specifically, found in Joshua chapter 1. And if you have your Bibles, I'll ask you to turn there. Mine's already there. The reason is this. In Joshua chapter 1, Moses has already expired and Joshua is being set into position to lead. He has been a lieutenant, a very faithful lieutenant to Moses for many years. But as he now is assuming this mantle of leadership under God's direction, chapter 1 is a private conversation with God and Joshua. And the Lord brings out in that passage, as we will see this morning, three very strong issues or keys that he encourages Joshua to remember so that he can be successful in his leadership. Now, I think that's significant because of all the passages in the Bible where you and I might go and say, God talks about leadership here or here or here, I'm not sure that I know of any other passages that encapsulate all of these ideas in one concentrated vision like we find in Joshua chapter 1. And if he held those up for Joshua and said, these are the things that will set you apart as a leader of God's people. These are the things that will help you and them to be successful in the divine sight, heaven's sight. Surely those are keys or principles that ought to be acknowledged by anyone who would seek to lead and to serve God and his people. So we're going to look at those and talk about each of these ones and do so with respect to our four figures that we've mentioned. And also think about how it is that we can put into practice some of the things that we observe here. I want to begin by reading chapter 1, verses 1 through 6, where we see a well-defined purpose. God says, after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass, the Lord spoke unto Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' minister, servant, saying, here it is, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, and unto the land which I do give to them, even to the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread on, that have I given unto you, as I said to Moses. From the wilderness and this Lebanon, even unto this great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, and unto the great sea toward the going down of the sun will be your borders. There shall not any man be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so will I be with you. I will not fail you nor forsake you. Be strong and of good courage, for unto this people you will divide for an inheritance the land which I swore unto their fathers to give them. The first thing that God says to Joshua is that he has a well-defined purpose that he is going to execute or achieve under God's auspices or his leadership. And the key phrase that's actually repeated several times with every one of these principles in this chapter is found at the beginning of verse number 6. Be strong and of good courage. Other places, be strong and very courageous. Now that is God, in a sense, being a cheerleader to build up and encourage this man, Joshua, who's going to lead this group of people. And the first thing he says to him is, Joshua, you're going to go and you're going to fulfill a goal or a purpose. Now, I want us to notice, first of all, he tells Joshua, the purpose or goal that you're going to serve is one that has roots back in time to previous figures and activity. In other words, there's a sense of heritage to the leadership that Joshua is providing. You, Joshua, are carrying forward the work that has been building for all this time, and it will far outlive Joshua as well. But he is building on the shoulders and passing along the bigger picture of what it means to be God's people and to achieve these divine purposes. I think about that with Moses back in Exodus chapter 3 when God appeared at the burning bush. And he tells Moses, I've heard the afflictions of my people. I'm going to send you. You're going to lead them. Moses was fulfilling promises made way back to Abraham and even back to the garden with the words to Adam and Eve. When Joshua serves, he's fulfilling this sense of continuity. Nehemiah, he doesn't get as much playtime as the other three of these figures, I think. But in the book of Nehemiah, chapter number 1, it's now 1,000 years later than this, approximately. The people of Israel are in captivity. The city has been brought low and destroyed. The temple has been built up, but the walls of the city are still broken. It's still like living in a war zone, we would say. And so Nehemiah hears about these things as he's serving as a cupbearer in the court of the Emperor Artaxerxes. He hears about these things of his homeland and his heritage, and he says that's his heart is broken. Okay, it's a terrible situation. And it works out so that he's able to make a petition to the leader, Artaxerxes, and to say, could I go back to Jerusalem? And could I try to see after the needs of the people and rebuild things? He even goes so far as to ask the king, would you provide some resources for me? And the king does. And so Nehemiah goes back. Well, God had foretold the return of the Jews. It wasn't a surprise perhaps to anyone except Nehemiah and Artaxerxes and their contemporaries. But he's continuing a story. And of course, Jesus. We talk about Jesus. He knew, of course, what was behind him and what he was building on. But Jesus had a very clear sense that he was here about God's business. From the time he was 12 in Luke chapter 2, and his parents had kind of lost him in the city of Jerusalem, to his adult years, of course, John chapter 4, verse 34. He's been talking with the woman at the well. And he talks with his apostles when they come back, and he says, my meat, my food, is to do the will of him that sent me. And in quick succession over several chapters, he repeats that idea, I'm here to do God's business. As a director of a preaching school, as an elder in a congregation, I think anybody who's attempting to help lead forward in whatever capacity, it's good to be aware I'm really being about my Father's business. And I can say that in a very genuine sense, as can you. So I need to feel a sense of responsibility to do that. But I want to take it just a little bit further than that. You realize these four figures that we've mentioned did not just talk about the big picture, the grand plans, and they never got down to brass tacks. That's not the case at all. I really want to encourage brethren, preachers, whomever it may be, leaders, to be careful about strategizing, analyzing, hypothesizing, about digitizing, and about harmonizing and generally paralyzing things to death. At the end of the day, the grandest plans require a small step to begin executing something that has already been mapped out as far as possible. And tomorrow will require another step. And the next day, another step. And it is amazing to me. You know, I remember being told as a little boy, I thought, man, I'm busy. Or a teenager, I'm busy. My parents said, wait, it's not even what it's going to be. And I know that, and you probably would concur with that idea. And I will look down and I will think, wow, at the School of Bible Studies, I had an idea that I wanted to implement last July. It is May. I better get started on that. Because all kinds of things seem to creep in and I don't get where we want. And the need has been there. Obviously, it hasn't been crippling because we've managed to go along. But I stop and remind myself that little progress every day to goals and plans that we put in front of our minds are going to help us go a long way. You know, Jesus, he did his carpentry work. He supported himself. But at the right time, he called his 12. At the right time, he commissioned the limited commissions. At the right time, he began his more limited journeys and tours around Israel and Judah. And then he prepared his disciples and others to go out after him. Big plans, the cross, the whole scheme of redemption. But he knew, I need to execute this here and this here and this here in order to achieve things. Our goal, it's repeated three times in the book of Ephesians chapter 1, is to live to the praise of God's glory. To live to the praise of God's glory. Ephesians 1, verse 6, verse 12, and verse 14. Well, okay, great. How does that happen? Chapter 2, verse 10. Paul says, we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus, unto good works. Well, somebody says, what are those? We've got to sit down and figure them out. Not really. Good works which he has prepared in advance that we should walk in them. God already has a sense of what he wants the church to accomplish. Now, the doing of that day by day, month by month, year by year may fall to us to map or plan given our circumstances, where we live, what we're doing. But to take the big picture opportunity and to boil it down to what can we do to achieve. Rick, what do you want to do? I want to convert the world. Great. What are you going to do? What's your first step? How will you measure success? What are you going to do when you run into an obstacle? Et cetera, et cetera. Those types of details need to be addressed. We get things rolling. Brethren, I'm convinced that sometimes criticism that comes to leadership, whether in government or business, the home, a school system, or in a congregation, is because there is a great talk about doing big things that never actually get off the ground. And for followers who do want to see things, they're gung-ho, they're energized, they want to achieve things, it can be frustrating. They can't run ahead of leadership, but they can be hampered by leadership that won't go, right? And that's frustrating even for very submissive, very faithful brethren, because you can see the need, but out of respect for someone else's leadership, they don't run ahead of it, but things maybe don't get done or fall through the cracks. And that's a challenging circumstance. It is for me as well at school. What I would propose that we do, we are congregation number X here, where you labor and where you work. I would propose that you or your elders, or your brethren, in general leadership too, if it's a men's committee, it doesn't change anything. If you've not already done this, I would propose that you think, what are the works that we are engaged in here? And you draw, did this on the back of a napkin one day, and it turned out to be one of the nicest doodles that I had. Let's talk about evangelism. What are we doing in the area of evangelism? What about in the area of benevolence? What about in the area of edification? Okay. These are the big areas that God talks about. And so what is it that this particular congregation is doing to achieve these kinds of things? And this is what leadership needs to talk about. For example, in evangelism, how do we connect with our visitors? Those are people who've already said, I'm interested at some level. Are we letting them get out the door? Are we following up with them? What are we doing? Or maybe we're going to have a gospel meeting, and it's going to focus on reaching out to, or we're going to make sure that we have a canvassing, a neighborhood, whatever the case may be. This chart is drawn, and you map here what you do to achieve these goals. Then we come over to edification. Well, that's building up the people who've already been reached and helping us to grow and to be strong. I can think, for example, about our Bible classes. Yep, we've got to do that. We want to do it with our sermons. Maybe at some point we want to make sure, we might want a seminar, okay, a weekend kind of thing where we bring in someone to talk about how to have a good, strong family. And it's not always, I would encourage, not always just talking about here's how to turn the lovey-dovey feelings of newlyweds into, you know, long-term love and lasting. I would encourage you to challenge where the needs are. Have somebody come in and talk about how to solve problems that exist. You know, we hear a lot, and it's okay. I preach a lot about the rose-colored images of life and activity, but let's talk about where the breakdowns are. How do we handle those? And those may be the people they think, we're the only ones. Because everybody, you know, we don't parade, and I'm not saying that we need to parade. All of our problems and breakdowns and frailties. But do we, as leadership, provide a proactive sense of addressing what are the big goals that we want to achieve? So maybe it's something like that. What are our edification and build-up? It may be a vacation Bible school. It may be a church. Whatever it is that you do. Benevolence. How do we take care of the widows and the orphans? Do we have a food pantry that we do? Is there something that we do in our community where we help out? All right? What happens when somebody comes and knocks on the door? By the way, let me just tell you, one of the best gifts you will give to the preacher who preaches for you, if you don't have this already, is when somebody comes to the door, can I talk to the pastor because I got, I need to pay my rent. They're about to kick me and my three children out. Or I need a prescription. I'm running out and I need it. And, you know, it's a life-saving, life-threatening kind of situation. When I was a beginning preacher, the congregation where I worked, I'm not critical, we just didn't know. We had no policies, no planning about how we would handle those types of requests. And so I was constantly, we had no elders at the time, I was constantly saying, can we have a meeting after services real quick? We've had a request. Can I have a meeting after services real quick? We've had a request. I felt frustrated by it. They felt frustrated by it. I came to San Marcos, to university congregation. It was like a breath of fresh air. Because the congregation here and the eldership had already said, this is what we do. And where I am now at Southwest, for example, we don't help with rent. There's so many that come and knock on our doors in Austin. We could empty the bank's coffers in a heartbeat by things like that. We've also said we will help with food. We'll sometimes help somebody with a little bit of medicine or something like that. Okay, we try to make a difference, but we only have such a sizable pool, just like you. One of the things that they decided is we only help people one time. Members internally, that's a different discussion. People knocking on the door, we help them one time. Why? There are so many. We want to try to help as many as we can. We keep great records. And we have a couple of deacons that handle that. Somebody knocks on the door, I say, would you please... I said, just a minute, let me call so-and-so. I don't ever give out their name because they end up being peppered by requests, and people share oftentimes the connections, right? Don't pass out phone numbers, please.
Right.
Your deacon will kill you and then repent. but that's a great thing. Our deacons keep records. We had one fellow who came in and said, this is the situation. I said, tell you what, why don't you? And I called my friend Ira, never gave the last name. Would you mind talking to Mr. Ira? Sure. He talked, and Mr. Ira said, you came in 1984, and you had that exact same story for us. And the guy said, you're right. You got me. And then he gave the phone back and he left. I was still in high school in 1984. I had no idea, right? And so here is good record keeping that made sure we didn't enable poor behavior or deceptive requests. Now we've got things we can do to help people well. Those types of things, what is your... So I would encourage you as an eldership or a leadership to sit down at some point when you have time to sit and think, what is it that we are currently doing? And maybe take time to reflect, come back in a month or whatever the situation is, and say, where do we feel like there are some absent elements that we want to focus on? Or what are some things we would like to add that we feel like we're going to be able to maybe in 6 months or in 1 year or something like that? And then analyze or assess, come back in a year and a half and just look and say, how has it worked? If there's been something that we've been doing, maybe in our evangelistic effort, that doesn't seem to get a response, then don't continue it, perhaps. But maybe you've come across a different aspect or approach that you can implement. Great, let's give this a try. Or whatever it may be for building up the congregation. We've had really good response. Well, let's continue to do those kinds of things. But it rests on the eldership to kind of have this big roadmap. Now, for many of you in the business world and maybe even starting your own businesses and things, this is nothing that doesn't exist in a good, well-functioning business out there. The question is whether that type of top-down planning and sense of purpose exists in the body of the Lord's people. And it can. And in fact, I find it very, very empowering because it suddenly means that we can address things and I don't feel like it's all out of whack or it's all about to cascade and overwhelm me. Alright. Along the way, I want us to point out that this is all revolving around people. Moses, Joshua, Nehemiah, and Jesus all were interested in what happened for people. Moses getting the Israelites out to their own place, Joshua to their own land, Nehemiah helping his brethren, Jesus helping people. And the reason that I mention that is because it is easy for us to get caught up in the mundane aspects of our goals and our decision making. Yes, there is a lawn that needs to be mowed. There are hallways that need to be cleaned and have attention. There are letters to write, lectureships to attend. But I encourage good leadership does not lose sight of the fact that man was not made for the institution or the activities. The activities are for the human, to borrow a line and adapt it from Jesus, right? And so it is easy for me to envision, and I've been around elderships, I've talked to, and you know, just in the life of the church, elderships who sometimes forget that or never thought about it. Your very designations in the Bible, elder, shepherd, pastor, or overseer, a few different terms that are used, each have some special aspect that they bring out that helps serve this issue of purpose. Elder, older, wiser, experienced. How many of us have our grandkids or kids come to us and ask us how to program the remote controls or how to get the Xbox to work? Okay, none. But I go to my parents or my grandparents or my elders for people issues, for life issues, for those types of things. So if an elder or an eldership drops from the bigger picture of people down to the trenches of executing every plan, calling and getting the specs for the new speakers for the sound system, or, hey, we need a new lawnmower for the... That is time spent on things that a non-elder can do. I want an elder that I can approach who's got time to talk to me about how I can iron out problems with my kids, or how we can work out a problem with the congregation, or how we can seize a new opportunity maybe to talk to a few more people. You see, it's people-oriented. The issue of shepherd or pastor is all about feeding. And you may remember Acts 20:28, the responsibility for feeding is not the preacher's responsibility. It isn't mine as a director, except as a tool used by leadership. So, and then overseer. You do oversee, but I encourage you to think about delegating. I heard a preacher say one time, got into a congregation, was working, how are things going after a number of years? He said, great, the elders are now eldering, the deacons are now deaconing, and the preacher is now preaching. And it's a great arrangement. And it is. In Acts chapter 6, verses 1 through 7, there was a need to take care of these widows who needed some assistance. A very important task. Had to be done. But the apostles told the congregation, we are making sure that we're proclaiming the gospel and sharing the message of salvation. We don't want to take away from that time to handle this because there's a better solution we can work out. We want to find qualified men who can handle this. We will delegate it. We know what's happening, but we're going to let them handle it. And we'll keep our mind here. Now, I don't know what works and things it is that you may need to manage, but I can tell you that at Southwest, where I live and work and know some of the inner dealings, those are busy men. A couple of them still have their own kids and families at home, teenagers, but still, you know. We do camp. We do a youth retreat. We do gospel meetings. We just got done with a lectureship. They like to come to events like this and other, you know, area congregations, gospel meetings. We have visitation program. We have a benevolence effort. We have the school that they eventually oversee. If they were to give just 1 hour to each one of those things a week, they will be dying. They will be dying. And they won't have the chance to achieve what they want. And there's no need for that, really. In your Bibles, I want to turn back to the book of Exodus, chapter 18, for just a minute. I think this is a perfect illustration of the principle that we're trying to get across. Exodus chapter 18, and I want to start in verse number 13. I hope it's okay with you. I'm spending a little bit more time on this one because I think this one is worth exploring. And some of the other things we'll say in a few minutes are important, but I think they're also more straightforward and obvious. Exodus chapter 18, beginning in verse 13. It came to pass on the morrow, Moses sat to judge the people. The people stood by Moses from the morning until the evening, so all day. When Moses' father-in-law saw everything that he did for the people, he said, what is this thing that you're doing to the people? Why are you sitting yourself alone and everybody's parading before you from morning to evening? Moses said, because the people come to me to inquire of God. In other words, they want to know certain things, or they may need help, or how do we resolve this issue, etc. When they have a matter, they come to me, and I judge between one and another. I do make known to them the statutes of God and his laws. And his father-in-law said, the thing that you're doing is not good. Now, it's not that the item itself is bad, it's the process. And so he said, you will wear away, and you and this people that are with you, it's too big for you, you're not able to do it yourself. And if you read the rest of the text in this chapter, he will say, why don't you appoint people who are qualified and capable and delegate and let them take care of these things so you can handle the things that only you can do. My wife gets on to me sometimes in a constructive way. You roll up your shirt sleeves and you go to work. I need some copies made that I need to pass out to the student body at the beginning of the school year or whatever. And so I would be, if I didn't think ahead, I would be standing at the copier for 3 hours and going over, punching the holes, collating and binding and all that. And my wife says, what are you doing? That is why you have the administrative assistants that are here. That's their task. You give it, they'll do it, they'll get it to you, you'll make sure that it's done right, but you have other things that only you can do. And she's right. And the more I listen to her or the administrative assistants, and I think, you're right, I don't have to do that. I can let go of it. I don't have to be in those trenches. The better off I am. Lower stress, more effective in the things that fall to the director or the teacher. And I can't pass those off. Same thing for elders. I really encourage you in looking at something like this, who is handling all these things, you do not need to be in the trenches. A negative way to say it would be micromanaging, but I don't want to make it sound bad. It's just an awareness. Everybody benefits when you can hand it off. Heard about a congregation, the elders wanted to get a van. They laid out the specifications for what they wanted in this, and they handed it to the deacon and said, here's the budget, go find something that works. They took care of it, you know? Well, that's not much different than handling the food and the money to feed the widows in Acts chapter 6. Why? We've got other things to take care of. I encourage you to look at it that way and make use of the people that are around you. And you do them a favor too because they also get better at doing and they grow. And they're capable and you use their talents and abilities and it lets you stay above to dip in. I'd really like to see the shepherd aspect heightened, strong, where we meet with people. Ministers do not mind, preachers do not mind meeting with people who have an issue. Knock, knock, knock. I want to talk to you. I'm having trouble with my life. That's fine. But how nice would it be if there were elders also? Because I have no formal training in counseling and things. I just try to do my best and I know the Bible. So do our elders. So do you, you know. So elders know the Bible and they want to do their best. But they can learn as easily as I, and they have more experience in life and things. Wouldn't it be great if the people looked to you and the wires and the cables and filling up the car and changing the tire was handled by somebody else? You have a special role that you can fill better than anybody else. That's why you were appointed to the position that you're in. For Moses, got to get the people through the wilderness safely. For Joshua, got to get them to the land of Canaan safely. For Nehemiah, got to get back and put our lives on track safely. For Jesus, got to get them to heaven safely. For elders, got to get these people to heaven. This is a mechanism to do it. Number two, in the book of Joshua, chapter number one, the second principle to bring out is found in verses 7 and 8. Having well-defined principles. Verse 7, only be thou strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded thee. Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. This book of the law will not depart out of your mouth. You will meditate therein day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written therein. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. What does it take to be an effective elder, leader, preacher, director? It is to be committed to practicing the principles God revealed. I'm not authorized. I'm not even smart enough to make up the right principles. I can use the wisdom and knowledge and the learning from other people to implement successfully the principles that God has already presented. Moses, the new lawgiver. Joshua and his whole generation. We're told in Judges chapter 2 and verse 10 that when Joshua and his generation expired, there arose a generation that knew not the Lord, nor yet the works of the Lord on behalf of Israel. And they plunged into all types of problems. Well, what that tells me is that Joshua was a man who took this charge seriously, and so did his contemporaries, and they kept the nation on track. Nehemiah. I read in Ezra chapter 8, I've misspoken, in Nehemiah chapter 8, where Ezra and the others are gathered at the water gate. It's a very famous scene. And they have all the people there and they read from the law distinctly. Nehemiah was there. Ezra may have been the leading figure as a religious voice. But Nehemiah, the civil leader and Jewish figure, was there. And they encouraged the people. They taught the people. They lived by those principles. And, of course, I don't have to say that Jesus also was defined by trying to live by, and he did live by, what God revealed as his will. There are too many people who try to climb to the top using strategies. They can be Machiavellian. They try to get ahead. They're chameleon-like. And honestly, brethren, I'm not surprised that people are sometimes jaded, even suspicious about leaders. It's just the way that it is. And I think in many ways it's deserved. There are figures who pander, they promise, they pretend, they'll do anything they can to try and get to some position on a ladder. And people get tired of being used and just being given, you know, false words. It's in business, it's in politics, could be in our neighborhoods. Hence the joke, right? How do you know when a politician is lying to you? Because his lips are moving, right? And it's really a loss because, where's the statesman? If I say he's not just a politician, he's a statesman, that starts to lift the bar a little bit. In a democratic America, we may not use the word aristocrat too much, but there's a real sense in which the heritage of that word has a good view. It's built in the idea of being led by the best. Now, for many, that's going to be the best who are the most famous, the most wealthy, or whatever. But if it's best in character, then we are an aristocracy. Or we ought to be, in a sense. God is the best, and he delegates to elders who meet these qualifications to be the best character, which is defined by how closely we pay attention to what the Lord asks. And then we help and encourage other people to do the same kinds of things. If people find poor leadership everywhere else, where is the one place they ought to be guaranteed to find something that is refreshingly great? And it's in the Lord's church. We are a haven. And we talk about a haven in terms of refuge from sin, a refuge from Satan, a refuge from temptation. But I really wonder how many times we thought about the church as a refuge or a haven from terrible leadership to thoughtful, caring leadership where people take interest in us and interest in God's Word and help us walk the right path. That is invaluable. And it's sad when in the church or in religion in general, it's the other way. Paul criticized in Romans chapter 2, verses 21 through 24. He criticized many of his Jewish readers. He said, you know the law. You're a teacher of the law. You teach others, but you don't teach and do yourself. He said, you would stand against idols, but do you turn away from God? You would teach against stealing. Do you steal against adultery? And the upshot in verse 24 is the name of God is blasphemed among the nations because of you. Not unknowing, but unperforming. Then Peter, 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 1, 2, and 3, he talks about in the church that there are false teachers, leaders. And he says in verse 2 at the close, because of them, the way of truth is evil spoken of. And what's more, in verse 3, they make merchandise of you, Joe, average Christian. That's not the leadership that the world needs or wants. He closes that chapter by talking about these types of leaders. And he says they're like storm clouds that come in. They don't really have any rain. They're all show, nothing to them. And in Central Texas, we know what that's like, right? And you just wish, if only, if only. Well, it's one thing about the weather. It's another thing about leaders in the Lord's church. We want to be people who know what God's Word is. That's why we're able to teach it. I encourage you to consider teaching a Bible class if you're not already, or at least be the full-time or regular substitute for the preacher when he's away. Step up and do that. And then it saves him having to, and one of the things as a teacher, when I go away for, a summer series or gospel meeting, I have to find someone to fill in for me. You know, among the best attendees at regular Bible class service times are elders and elders' wives. I mean, they're there, and that's a great thing. Consider the fact that you being apt to teach could step in because you've been sitting in there, you've been listening, and you know the people. And you can tailor the conversation. But you knowing God's Word can help other people to learn it by not only sharing it, of course also teaching it and practicing it. I want to wrap up with the last one. In verse number 9, Joshua enjoyed a well-recognized partnership. Have not I commanded thee, be strong and of good courage. Be not afraid, do not be dismayed. The Lord your God is with you wherever you go. He was with Moses, protected him against insurrection by Dathan, Korah, Abiram, and on. He was with Joshua. He was with Nehemiah, Jesus, and he's with us. We like things tactile. I want to be able to touch, feel, shake their hand, look them in the eyes. I can't do that with God. But that does not mean that Jesus' promise, I'll be with you to the end of the age, is not true and valid. It's a reason why Jesus talks in Matthew chapter 18 about the discipline that may need to take place against a brother who sinned against us. And he says, where two or three of you are gathered in my name, there I am. That is not simply saying that when a couple of us get together to have coffee at Starbucks and talk about spiritual things, Jesus pulled up a chair with us. That's not what it means. In context, what he's saying is when you do the business of the church and you do it the right way, I am a part of you and the activities you're engaged in. God works in providence. He works in circumstances, not miraculously, but in various ways. I can't diagnose them all. I can't identify them, and I don't need to. Jesus said, I'll be with you. I'll never leave you. I'll never forsake you. Hebrews chapter 13, and I believe that. We ought to be confident that we're going to live by God's principles no matter what anyone else thinks, because one plus God is a majority. I don't care if everybody's criticizing my decision. What can I go to bed at night and feel good about in my conscience because I'm God's person following His law, not to the right, not to the left? What matters is what God says in terms of approval. Now, let me wrap up and close with this, and we're out of time, I know. Here in Joshua chapter 1, if you look, starting in verse number 10, Joshua is going to talk to the people and tell them about God's plans. He tells them what God intends to do and how they're going to get there, and they can count on Him. I want you to notice verse number 16 to the end. They answered Joshua, this is the nation, they answered Joshua saying, all that you commanded us, we will do. Wherever you send us, we will go. According as we've listened to Moses in all things, so we will listen to you. Only the Lord your God be with you as He was with Moses. And whoever he is that does rebel against your commandment will not listen to your words and everything you command him, he will be put to death. Notice the last phrase of this chapter, only be strong and of very courageous or of good courage. Now it's the people saying to Joshua, if you'll do what's right as a leader, we've got your back. We'll follow you. We won't murmur and complain. That's why the book of Joshua is, as a whole, seen as a great book of victory. Quality leadership on the right principles, followed by good people who know the value of those principles and the God they serve, and they're able to celebrate. I will close with this thought. I have friends who attend a congregation with a very strong eldership, very good, very faithful, very steady Eddie in all the right ways. The very principles we're talking about. I asked my friends, how do you like being there? And they said, Rick, we are in a congregation where we feel safe. We're taught, we're fed. If there's a crisis, it's handled effectively and well. And we all work in harmony. We'll sort out any problems, but we're good. I think that's a real compliment to God and His plan, but to the men who put that into practice. And it can be any of us that do that. May God bless us all in our work for Him, for His kingdom. And the people will appreciate this type of leadership. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rick.